from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, when New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast's elderly parents started down the slippery slope of dementia and hospital stays, she found herself dealing with the difficult emotions, end-of-the-life paperwork, and expensive nursing homes. She channeled her stress into producing a graphic memoir titled Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? She'll join us for the hour next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And we're joined this hour by veteran New Yorker cartoonist and author Roz Chast, the only child of Brooklyn-based public educator parents. She recently published a graphic memoir called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? It's all about caregiving for her elderly parents as they aged and became increasingly enfeebled. And she joins us for this morning's second hour. I'm delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, where to begin? One of the biggest impressions I came away after reading your book was we're kind of sold a bill of goods about the golden years. You can't help realizing, because of your honesty and because of the way you uncover what you went through, and some of it's funny, of course, because it has your wit to it, but just how difficult this experience of caregiving can be. Your parents lived into their 90s, and they just kept going downhill.
Yeah, it's not something that people talk about too much. I think that people probably call it the golden years because if they didn't talk about it at all, it would be a sort of glaring omission. And so they make up this thing about the golden years. And I think most people do know it's kind of a crock.
It's also a tremendous onus, which with your wit and your cleverness, you also make abundantly clear. That is, the expense, the burden, the guilt, the denial, all of that, and the dependency. I mean, suddenly you've got really parents who you were dependent on who are dependent on you.
That's true. And to some extent, I think it was ever thus. But there's also this added factor, which is, you know, something I think about the age in which we live, which is that in the past, I think people got to a certain age, and for the most part, they got to that age, and they got sick, and they got weaker, and they died. And I'm not advocating that, you know, saying that this would be a great thing for everybody to die at 65, but that now with modern medical science, it's sort of possible to prolong life for a lot of people way past when they themselves want to be alive.
All this new technology.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you have resilient spirits like your mother who are pretty much ready to write her off. And then suddenly you come in one day and there she is with her shoes and eating a tuna fish sandwich. And you say, where's the tuna fish sandwich? And it's Kubler-Ross stuff. eating a tuna fish sandwich.
Yeah.
I also want to there's so much to touch upon, but you were really trying to be a good daughter, and you were feeling that sense of I wasn't a great caretaker, great as a caretaker. At one point, you say they weren't great in being taken care of, but with all due deference, you were taking care of them, and you were stepping up to the plate. And I know that you went through all this ambivalence, but at the same time, whether you realize it or not, you're kind of a model for people who may not be able to take it and stand up to it.
I don't feel that way. I mean, I feel like, I don't think that there are a lot of great options out there. And that was something that I don't think I really knew until I had to face it, that the options were either running away from it and, you know, letting the chips fall where they may, you know, just not dealing with my parents' increasing, you know, enfeeblement and my father leaving the stove on and my mother falling and just saying, you know what, I wash my hands of all this and I'm an only child, but like, you know, I'm just out of here. That's not a good option. And I don't think emotionally I was capable of that option. Then there was the hiring full-time, round-the-clock care for them in enabling them to stay in their apartment, but hiring. They did not want that. It was a small apartment. They did not want a stranger living in there with them. And I didn't feel that was a good option because I was living two and a half hours away, and that would have made me very anxious, you know, just what is going on there and is this person trustworthy and what happens if that person gets sick and then the agency sends over another person that, you know, my parents don't even know, and that was sort of spooky. And so the option of taking of finally taking them out of their apartment and putting them in the book I call it The Place, which was an assisted living place about 10 minutes from me, that was
in Connecticut.
Yeah. It was not great, but it was the best option of all the not good options.
The least of evils, as the old cliche would have it.
Yeah.
But then you talk about the trust issue with your hiring somebody to take care of your parents. I mean, there was also a trust issue with your parents. I mean, as they were starting to decline, for example, your mother brought up this whole thing about cashmere sweaters.
Oh.
I mean, she thought that maybe you would become profligate in your spending the way other people, somebody named Melman did, who she mentions. And your mother also had a lot of distrust for her. There's a woman who lives near her, and she was being kind. She has a slight German accent. Your mother thinks maybe she's a Nazi. There's all of that kind of.
Well, actually, it was my father who.
I mean, your father. Yeah.
But there was it. I think it's, you know, when you realize you're becoming dependent on other people, I think there's something that goes along with that where maybe you get very nervous because you realize how, you know, you might have to trust these people to help take care of you, and you're no longer capable of completely taking care of yourself. It was a strange time of life, and it's someplace where we're all going. I mean, that was the other thing about watching my parents go through this, was that, you know, unless an air conditioner falls on my head someday when I'm walking through Midtown, or I get, you know, God forbid, some horrible illness that takes me. Well, maybe that's not God forbid. Maybe that would be good. I don't know. That this is where we all are going. It's this moving sidewalk, you know.
We're talking with Rose Chast, her new book. This is a graphic memoir in every sense of being graphic, too. Authentic about her life. It's called Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And her parents did not like to talk about death and what to do about it, or money. There's one of those aha moments for you when you're going through a lot of their belongings, closets full of accumulated stuff, and you realize that you have these too, and you call it postmortemistically the awareness of what longevity carries with it.
Yeah, well,
this is your road too, as you see it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, my husband and I were talking about, we got to go through the stuff. So, you know, I mean, you wind up, you have like seven, you know, can openers, and, you know, four of them don't really work. And why didn't I throw them away? I don't know. Maybe one day I was going to open up a can opener museum. You just have this accumulation of, I'm not talking about Fabergé eggs here, but just like ratty sweaters and a bathrobe from like last century, and, you know, all this, you know, LPs, videotapes of, you know, Barney, or, you know, it's just like stuff that needs to get out of the house so that my kids don't have to deal with it.
And all this stuff, was accumulated along with bank books and other sorts of things that meant a great deal to your parents. And so you had to step in and try to navigate through all this. And when you talk about trust, you actually did find a Jamaican woman who you trusted and who worked well with your mother. But then there was all that ambivalent feeling, you know, she's a minority. We take advantage of minorities by using them for help. I feel guilty. She's taking care of my mother. I'm not taking care of my mother. I mean, you lay all that out, and you're grateful to her, of course, too. And feel tender. So it's a mix of emotions.
It was definitely a mix of emotions all the way through. And I think that's partly what I wanted to write about.
And it's also going back to Brooklyn. I mean, you really give us a kind of multidimensional and nuanced view of your parents and who they were. And I couldn't help but thinking, particularly since you put them under the spotlight and talk about their idiosyncrasies and some of their difficulties, although I think the love shines through ultimately. But I wonder how they would have responded in their prime to this kind of portrait.
I think my father might have understood it. I'm not so sure about my mother.
Your mother was one tough lady, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was very, very tough. I think there's also there's a lot of things here. I mean, there was her upbringing, but there's also the generational difference. And I've been thinking about this more, and I was thinking, you know, when she – my parents were both born in 1912, and that's a whole other thing from a baby boomer, which I am. And
– But they had you late.
They had me very late.
And they also lost a child before you were born. So it was very difficult in many ways in extenuating kinds of circumstances.
Yes. And they did have very hard lives. They both grew up very poor. They graduated from college into the Depression, and I think that they saw the kind of anything that was very introspective or complaining or talking about, you know, depression or anything like that. My mother particularly saw it as belly aching or navel gazing or just something sort of stupid and weak and selfish, and that you just didn't. Go around saying, I feel sad because of that. It was like, you know, shut up. You have food in the house. You have a roof over your head. You don't know what trouble is. You know, you're just, buck up.
I know what trouble was, though. When your mother got angry, that was trouble. A blast from Chast. In fact, there's a moment in the book. I couldn't help kind of relishing this moment in a way. Forgive me. But your father's trying to get a key in a door, and he's going, oh, my God. And you go bats. You become your mother in a sense.
Oh, absolutely. I completely lost it. I mean, that was when my mother was in the hospital, and my father came to live with us because he could not be left alone in the apartment. He was much more senile than I thought, and he really could not be left alone. And so he came to live with us in Connecticut, and we would go into Brooklyn almost every day to see my mother in the hospital. And he was so obsessed with the idea that somebody was going to break into the apartment and steal the bank books, many of which were from banks that had gone out of business like 20 years before. But it gave him such comfort to know that he had looked at them. And why didn't he take them with? I don't really even remember why. It was just like they had to stay where they were, which was in some file cabinet or something. And maybe it was just he needed to check on the apartment also and to make sure it was still there, and it was a way for him to center himself. Anyway, so one time I brought him there, and it was just – this whole thing was exhausting, and, you know, I was at the end of my rope. And the key was very glitchy because it was an old apartment. And he couldn't get the key to turn in the lock. Oh, and I would be the one to be, like, turning it, and it wasn't turning. And he started freaking out in the hallway.
Oh, my God.
You know, the key's going to break off in the lock. He just, like, got into a panic. And I just started screaming at him, and like I swore at him in the hallway because I was just at the end of my rope, and it was like, oh my God, I can't believe I did this. I like my poor senile father, and I like just told him, I'm not even going to say it because we're on the radio, but like I used language to just tell him that I was going to freak the something out if he didn't like pull it together.
Talking again with Roz Chast, and her new book is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant. You give us, as I say, a full and nuanced portrait of your parents, a multidimensional portrait, but also of yourself. And you were saying your mother didn't like you to say poor me or any of that sort of thing. But what comes across is a portrait of a young kind of, well, girl who went through a difficult childhood, who was shy, maybe even hostile and paranoid. you've used those words before, maybe even ADD. I mean, it was a troubling childhood.
Yeah, I was not a happy camper, as they say. No, I really I have no nostalgia for childhood or Brooklyn.
But yet when you went back to Brooklyn, you were kind of dragooned into almost, it's not that you can't go home again. Thomas Wolfe also said, only the dead know Brooklyn. But you, in effect, found this Brooklyn of your youth and found that it just didn't fit into your life when you had your own kids, your own family.
No, it didn't. We lived in Park Slope briefly, my husband and I. We lived on the Upper West Side, Manhattan, for a long time. And before my son was born in 1987, we moved to Park Slope. But Park Slope is really different from the part of Brooklyn that I was from. I mean,
it's now a haven for young people.
Yes. Well, there were young people. Even when in 87, there were lots of young people, families there. The part of Brooklyn that I was from was really, it was kind of off the map. It was the kind of place where if Dunkin' Donuts opened up a store, which it did, it was a cause for celebration because it was like, oh, my God, corporate America realizes that there are people here who have enough money to buy a donut at Dunkin' Donuts. That's like really a step up.
Well, you mentioned Dunkin' Donuts. I was charmed and I must say entertained by some of the names you give some of these places, like these homes, End of Trail Acres, Final Bridge, the Sunset Gardens, all these kind of parodying all the euphemisms until you get to the last stop.
Yeah. Well, these places do have these names that there was actually the New Yorker when they ran that excerpt, they fact checked that, and there was a Sunset Gardens retirement community someplace, but it was in another part of the country, so they let it go. But I mean, who names these places? It's terrible. It's just like it's my parody was just like one step away from the real thing.
Well, you write about things that are very difficult to write about. And again, I give you kudos for that. And I'm thinking about there's a scene in a book called Patrimony by Philip Roth, which you might know, where it's a scatological scene where his father loses control and becomes incontinent. And this is exactly what happens with your mother. And this, for Roth, becomes a real test of his love as a child, because somehow, of course, one's dignity is obviously lost in that kind of circumstance. And for you, it was a moment of truth, wasn't it?
It was, truth in that we know that the body fails, you know. And I think my mother was very humiliated, but I wanted to let her know that I know what the body is. I mean, it's horrible. It is horrible, but it's not, it's shocking in one way, but it's so unsurprising in another way. It's like this is... I mean, it was shocking when it happened, but actually it's not. It's like, this is what happens. This is what happens when people are extremely old. And it may happen to you. It may very well happen to me. It's like, this is what happens. And I think sometimes when I see these ads for some product for seniors on TV, like Centrum Silver or Depends or something, and the people in the ads are these sort of spry, you know, for all I know, they're like 55-year-olds that have been made up to look older, you know. They're really not, it's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about way, way past that.
And when you encounter actually the narrative and the story that you provide for us here, you realize that that you have to face death and you have to face your own mortality too, because there's nobody left ahead of you. And you did something, you did a lot of unusual things in this. You used real photographs, you used your mother's doggerel poetry. But at the end, it seems like you're compelled to want to draw your mother when she's really literally on her deathbed. And I was thinking, of course, of the photographs that Annie Leibovitz took of Susan Sontag. It reminded me of that, and because there was a lot of criticism of that, you know. But you were doing what you, I think, wanted to do in terms of making us look at the reality of what you were up against.
Yeah, and it was a way to spend time with my mother that wasn't just sitting and, like, looking. It was sitting and looking and drawing, which is what I do. It's what I've always done. It's what I've done since I was a child. It's what I do.
And it's still, for you, a way of removing yourself from trouble?
Yeah, I think so.
Or anxiety? Or
I think
whatever.
So, yeah.
Are you still
yeah.
afraid of balloons, by the way?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. I am. I hate balloons.
I just was curious about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And your mother, toward the end, had these surreal, you call them surreal dreams, which you cataloged and brought to our attention. And
yeah.
They're really quite something.
They're kind of funny and weird.
But people in their senility or their senescence, whatever you want to call it, they do come up with these evocative landscapes of imaginative narratives that you never even expected.
Oh, it was fascinating. And some of them, a lot of them, I could really see root of them, like what was causing them. Like, she wanted to be able to give me an apartment in New York. She knew how much I missed living in New York and that it was probably never going to happen because, you know, it turns out that, you know, neither my husband nor I are like, you know, tech magnates or, you know, any of that. We're, or, you know, Brazilian heiresses or anything. It's just it happens to be the case. And so she would have these strange, you know, I'd come in and we'd be talking about my kids and everything would be great. And it would be like this rational conversation. And then she'd tell me about some apartment that my mother had been an assistant principal. And so when I grew up, I would always hear about the Board of Ed. So she would say, the Board of Education owns an apartment that they gave me, and I'm going to give you this apartment. And I'd be like, Mom, well, where is this apartment? It's 550 Park Avenue. You know, it would. Or there was another one where my grandfather, Harry, who had died when I was three, it turned out he had stacks of $10,000 bills hidden, and I should go looking for them.
This is kind of like Nebraska. You know, she's wanted to give something to
me. She wanted to give something to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's very touching. And what's also touching is that you wanted to make that connection with your mother. You wanted to have the kind of mother-daughter talk that you long for and yearn for, and just never happened.
It did not happen. And I it's not like a movie. It's not like, you know, a TV movie or something where at the end you have a breakthrough and you have this talk and it's meaningful and it's great. And, you know, then the music comes up and then you find out who played like the nurse because she looked familiar, you know, the credits. And no, it didn't happen like that.
Would you suggest then, would maybe the wisdom here be to suggest that people who want to have those talks should have them earlier rather than later?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Probably I should have tried to have it earlier.
That's one of the lessons there.
Yeah.
A lot of the work here appeared in The New Yorker, and your work has been in The New Yorker since the late 70s, and much admired, I might add. And we had Bob Mankoff on, as I think I mentioned to you, your cartoon editor. He says he has to get all his cartoons approved by Remnick. Is that true?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that annoying?
I think that most people I know who are cartoonists were just so grateful that we can do this for a living, because I know for me there's nothing else I can do. There isn't. So if I have to put up with that, I'll put up with that.
One of the more, I think, moving moments is when you go to that apartment. Your parents are going downhill, clearly. And they were orderly people, for the most part, cleanly people. And suddenly there's grime everywhere.
Yeah. They really, I think at a certain point, and I've talked to other people who knew exactly what I was talking about with the grime. It's you just give up cleaning in the way that you used to and keeping on top of things. And, you know, the junk mail piles up and it's not dealt with in the newspapers and the magazines and the disorder and the grime, the kind of the coating that's on everything. And it's disturbing.
Let me open the phone lines. I want to invite listeners to join this conversation. We're talking about a number of things with Roth Chast, about taking care of elderly parents, obviously, about the kind of reality of it as opposed to what is often put forth in illusions about what it seems to be, at least in the mind of those who fantasize that it's easier than it is. And you may have some stories, succinct, we hope, that you want to share with us. But also, I'm interested in hearing from those of you who have questions for this is not an oxymoron, one of our more distinguished cartoonists. People may think distinguished cartoonists, they don't go together. Yes, they do, in Roth Chast. You can join us now. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. We invite your participation, your questions and comments. Again, join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or go right online, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @kqedforum. The book again, Can we talk about something more pleasant? This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Roz Chast, a cartoonist for The New Yorker and author, who tells the story, the heartbreaking loss of her parents through the cartoons that she's been doing many years now for The New Yorker. And when her elderly parents started down that slippery slope of dementia and hospital stays, she found herself dealing with rather difficult emotions, end-of-life paperwork, expensive nursing homes, and channeled her stress into producing a graphic memoir titled Can't We talk about something more pleasant. And she'll be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 p.m. And also, you can see some of these cartoons by going onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and get a view of them. Click on this segment. You can also communicate with us that way or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum, or call us. Our toll-free number, if you'd like to speak with Rod Shast, is 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org. I'm going to go to our callers in just a moment, but it's kind of an off-the-wall question. At one point in the book, you feel like maybe when you were a child, you thought you were adopted. And a lot of this may have to do with the fact, I bet, you were... It was kind of hard to conceive of your parents conceiving, wasn't it? I don't know how to put that more bluntly.
But isn't that true for a lot of people?
A lot of people, I suspect, where their parents are concerned. Yeah, but yeah. Yours were a very special case.
They were a lot older. The adopted thing, I can't imagine that I'm the only one that ever felt that. You know, where it's like, I cannot even imagine how I could be related. But I know, especially with my father, that there's so much that I realized that we had in common, you know, with the anxieties and all of that. And I definitely felt related to him.
And I should mention that my friend Steve Arkin is here to visit you because your father was his teacher, and he said he was a great French teacher.
Yeah. I think, well, they were both very much admired in the whole educational world.
Your mother was an assistant principal.
Yes, she was an assistant principal. But she had also been a teacher before that, and she was very much loved as a teacher.
What subject did she teach?
I think she was a grade school teacher, so she taught a lot of things. She taught music, she taught English, she, you know, math.
We'll go to our callers, and we begin with Ramona. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi there. I appreciate the opportunity to just tell Roz Shast that when my children come to clean out my house after my departure, they're going to be exasperated and astonished at the hundreds and hundreds of Roz Shast cartoons that are in file folders and in books and on the refrigerator and in every nook and cranny of my house. And that there are, you know, things, composers and music and books and things that I can't imagine my life without and getting through life without. And I seriously cannot imagine getting through life without Roz Shast cartoons.
Nice legacy to leave your children.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ramona. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from another caller forthwith here, and that's Ava. Good morning. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I am terrified of getting old. I am witnessing my own decline on a daily basis, and I'm wondering whether the lady there has suggestions how to prepare for my ultimate decline or death, because I don't have children. And I live in a small apartment that is a cozy place, and I have enough friends and church connections, but yet I'm basically looking into the abyss. Sorry, I'm nervous.
No, good of you to bring this up and appreciate your honesty. Roz, you have an honest response?
I also feel that I may be younger than you, but also looking into the abyss, even though I have children, but it doesn't matter. I mean, I feel like one of the things about doing this book and being with my parents in these last years of their life was realizing and thinking about my own mortality and realizing that we're all in the same boat, and we all always have been. I don't know if that's
well. In your
help.
Book, you talk about it was too bad we don't have opium pipes, or I don't think you're saying this with that necessarily to be funny. It's a
I was not being facetious when I think about the end. I mean, I don't think I want to live forever on Ensure or any of those things or the medical interventions. My mother at the end, when she was 96 and in very frail and very poor health, the doctor suggested that she have a colostomy. And it just seemed insane. It was, you know.
She even called her sister, and her sister.
Her sister thought maybe it was a good idea.
Yeah, yeah.
But.
Who gets surgery at that age, though? I mean.
Yeah, she was so frail, and I don't know. I think that it's good to have friends in the church connections, and for me, especially friends.
We thank you for the call, Ava. Good luck to you, and we hope it goes. Well, not too much of a descent into the abyss. Thanks for that honest call. We'll go to more calls in a moment. It's a listener named Mara who writes, I want to thank Ross Chass for being so incredibly honest about the realities of taking care of elderly parents. I'm living through this right now with two parents in their mid-90s, and it is brutal to experience them declining from highly independent people to people who are in real need of guidance and help but resist it mightily but can no longer function well. Ms. Chass has so vividly described the wide range of emotions I experience on a daily basis, extreme sadness, anger, resentment, helplessness, and then gratitude when I'm able to help and they accept the help. We are now at the point of having to decide whether it will be better for them to live apart, given my mother's increasing dementia and my father's own cognitive issues. They've been together 64 years, so this will be a profound change that might be the final blow to their dignity. They are in a wonderful retirement facility thanks to being good savers all their lives, but there has to be a better way to end a life with dignity when there is no quality of life or desire of the person to continue living.
I totally agree with everything that person just said. There's got to be is there a better way? I don't know, but I feel like there's got to be.
You want to talk about something more pleasant? At least. No. Here's Mike who writes on our website. I remember when Roz was one of many female cartoonists whose work appeared in National Lampoon. How did that happen when the Lampoon appeared to be pretty much a boys' club?
I don't know. I guess I just I feel like I probably was in denial about it being female being an issue, but I just always thought, well, I like to draw cartoons and I'm going to draw cartoons. And I didn't really, I think I had so many other issues that I was thinking about that being female was one of many, many issues.
So. We'll go to more calls for you. We go to Joan next. Joan, thanks for waiting. Join us on Forum. You're on.
Hi. I applaud so much Roz Chass' book and her bringing this difficult subject up. I had to place my husband a couple of years ago into a very good facility, but it was a very hard thing to do, and I could only do it because of the support group I was in and also because the neurologist encouraged me to do so. But it made our time together, what was left, much more pleasant because I didn't have to worry about all the just the daily difficulties of coping with somebody who can't remember, who can't function the way he used to. And so when I could visit, we could just talk about things that were, it would always be here and now because he didn't remember much about the past and he wouldn't recognize, he wouldn't think about the future 10 minutes later either. But it really makes a huge difference to be able to make that step to, if you can, put them in a long-term care facility.
Well, Joan, we thank you for that call. What's so sad in all this is, and I don't want to necessarily dwell in the lachrymose or sadness of it, but when you quote Proust at one point, and you know, Proust made us acutely aware of the fact that the mother who was older and dying was not the mother that was implanted in his mind, the mother he saw in his mind's eye, the mother who was his mother growing up. She was a different person, and she was a person who could not really hold her own. And there's all that to deal with, too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think also one thing this last caller was saying about there is this tremendous, it was a relief to me when my parents were in the place, and it wasn't, I felt bad bringing them out of their apartment because I know that that was not necessarily their first choice, but it was so frightening to think about them continuing to decline. My father keeping, you know, he would leave the stove on. My mother would call and tell me that. My mother, and she would fall, and my father would tell me, like, you know, don't tell mom, but, you know, she is falling a lot. And at least knowing that they were there, it did make it a little bit less, made me feel a little bit less crazy.
But you were always anticipating that phone call.
Oh, right? Absolutely. Yeah. And, absolutely.
And the other thing about this is, I mean, just the day-to-day things that one encounters. I remember my dad would not admit when he was in his early 90s that he wasn't driving well anymore. And, you know, he was a menace on the road and a menace to himself. And, you know, we got into this whole thing between siblings of can we take away his driving privileges? Can we do that? What about his dignity and his autonomy?
Oh, it's so awful. When I told my mother I didn't want her driving anymore, she, you know, even years later, she would say, "You clipped my wings." And, you know, she was a very independent, very self-sufficient person, very strong person. But she was just not capable of driving safely anymore. On her 97th birthday, I asked her what she wanted, and she said she wanted a car.
Well, she was going to get you an apartment.
Yeah.
At least you could do. Talking again, yes, with Roz Chaster. New book is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? She'll be a book passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock. And more of your calls. Hollis, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. My father passed at the age of 92 this past Sunday. And he had a relatively short period of decline in 2 months. And this is when Roz's, you know, all her book came out, and I've been following it and listening to her interviews, and that has been really a great comfort to me and my sister. In fact, I call my sister and say, "Roz Chass is on, you know, Fresh Air. Listen to this." So thank you for that. And my question is, one of the things you talked about that I've sort of been preparing myself because you talked about it was the enormous amount of paperwork that you weren't expecting. And already, you know, in the 5 days that he's passed, and he was extremely well organized and knew exactly what he wanted and was with it until the very end, already we're finding things kind of popping up that we go, "Wow, I didn't think about this." So my question is, what kinds of things have popped up since your parents' death that you were surprised by in terms of paperwork and, you know, forms to file? And
Hollis, before Roz answers your question, let me say sympathy for your loss, because it's pretty recent. Yeah, Roz, yes.
Oh, God, there was so much. There were just weird things, like there would be a bank account with like $800 in it, and But then I didn't know this, but power of attorney, I mean, I didn't know anything about these kinds of forms like power of attorney, healthcare proxy, any of that. But power of attorney ends when the person dies. So if your name is not on the account, that $800, then you have to do, I mean, I almost just threw in the towel. I remember that particular account. I almost just threw in the towel and said, "You know what? I'm just going to let this bank keep that money because they are making me jump through so many hoops." I mean, this is like a big time, multi-bajillion dollar bank, but they were making me go through so many hoops to
get. That's how they add a lot to their revenue.
Yeah. But then at the end, a couple of times I actually wound up in tears with a banking person because I thought I would have all of the proper, proper paperwork to. It became this kind of issue that was way beyond just the money. It was like, I can't believe that this bank is making it so hard for me to do this. I don't know. It was just crazy. Yeah, the paperwork really was overwhelming.
It's also the sadness of realizing and trying to make your parents understand that all they'd saved for these years was just going to their caretaking.
Yeah, you have to look at it like a black comedy. I mean, it would not have mattered if my mother had bought herself a cashmere sweater every day of her life. It would not have mattered at all. You know, all of the saving, all of the patched oven mitts, you know, but on the other hand, I was really glad that they had saved because, you know, I don't know what happens when you don't have any money. And then I guess the government, well, first they take away your house. I do know that that happens because until the government isn't going to take over until they take everything. But, I mean, I've heard even worse stories of places than the place that my parents were in. I mean, my parents, as I say in the book, I lay it out pretty clearly what the costs were. But
well, you sure do. You itemize it.
Yeah, I itemize it. I, you know, I think, you know, we should know this. And I don't mean to be gross about it. It's just that people should know. But recently I found out about somebody who was telling me that she put her parents – or her parents voluntarily went to a place. They were in their 80s. And to just go to this place, it cost them $450,000. Huh. And it's a long-term – it's like buying long-term insurance kind of. But to go to the place – and then on top of that, they had to pay rent. But if her parents, who were in their mid-80s, died like 2 years later – that place would still keep all of that money. It's really bizarre. I mean, they know how to structure this thing for, like, maximum, like, getting of money.
Here's John who writes, can the author talk about balancing the desire to fulfill a parent's needs and requests when some requests, imagining secret intentions, start to not make sense? My current experience is having a mother for whom I'm doing financial transactions within her estate without any logic or her desire to explain why. Was there a point you had to take over when a parent still assumed they had the faculties? I also wonder if the author can imagine a self-directed exit for herself at some later stage of her life.
I think that by the time my parents went to the place, by the time I was taking over the paperwork, they had sort of thrown in the towel of all of that. In fact, when they first went to the place, my father asked me whether they would still have to pay taxes, which of course they did. You know, they were getting pensions, and I took that over. So no, they had thrown in the towel on paperwork. And financial transactions. So, you know, thankfully, I didn't really have to deal with too much of that. And as far as final exit goes, I don't know. And I also am aware that my perspective on this may change as I myself get closer to the abyss. The same way that a 16-year-old might look at plastic surgery as something like, oh, it's so gross, it's so phony, why would anybody want to do that? Then you get to be like 55 or 60 and you look at, like, you know, some situation under your neck and you think, well, you know, okay, maybe I want to get rid of that. So, you know, things change. But I was not being completely facetious about this idea of something more to look forward to at the end of life, even if it shortens your life, whether, you know, opium or maybe like marijuana brownies or something like that. Something.
Or a Reuben sandwich.
Yeah, or a Reuben sandwich.
Your mother
say
she wants
God.
A Reuben sandwich and you just go out and get her a Reuben
yes,
sandwich?
Yes, got her a Reuben sandwich and she enjoyed it.
More of our calls in a minute. But Debbie writes, my father's 96, drives himself well to the senior center to dance and have lunch daily, still golfs well. Are we blessed or what?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's fantastic.
And Kathy writes, Ross, I've been in the same place, the falls, the paranoia, the grime, the rotten food, the old bank statements, leaving the stove on. Oy, you'll appreciate this story. After multiple fender benders and tickets, when we had to take my dad's driver's license away and remove his car, he called the police and reported that I had stolen his car, his own daughter. Oy. He then managed to go out and buy a new car with cash, $30,000. The dealer sold it to him despite lack of a driver's license. Could he afford this? Of course not. My mom passed away from complications of Alzheimer's. Dad is safe and reasonably content in assisted living now. He still talks about buying a new car. Thanks for your book. Kudos and hugs all the way around.
Oh, my God.
And Gary says, Ree, your comment on not liking the idea of a stranger in your parents' house and taking care of them. In my experience with my mother, a professional caretaker quickly stops being a stranger and becomes a very valuable friend. That caretaker had professional skills that gave my mom much better care than I could have ever provided. And given that such caretakers are also from a foreign culture, the experience can be an interesting cultural experience for both me and mom.
That's great.
Here's another caller. Ramesh, good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate your show. Question that I have is I've been reading a lot, thinking a lot about this myself, and one of the things that crossed my mind was the assisted suicide law that got passed in Oregon some time back. And, you know, I just wanted to see what your thoughts were, what the thoughts of your guests were, you know, on that, because I think we all inevitably come to this stage where we think, you know, haven't I had enough of it? You know.
Oh, we're back to the question of the hemlock, Rasha.
Yeah. I think if you're in your right mind and you think you've had enough, I think that should be your decision. I mean, I'm all right with that.
Camus said it's the one philosophical question that one can answer autonomously, independently. Thank you for that call. Cecilia asked, did your parents know you were going to sketch them, or have you ever drawn them or family members before? You think they would have approved? Well, there's that question again, but...
Oh, it's a complicated one. I think that they knew that sometimes I think that they knew that sometimes they appeared in various forms in my cartoons. They probably had mixed feelings about it, not always positive. Somebody recently told me a quote, which was, the worst thing for a parent is to have a child who's a writer. I don't know. I mean, my daughter is a writer and an artist, and I told her, you know, that she should feel free to write about me and to draw me, and I think I want her to, you know, and to feel okay about it.
But you can, of course, you get into that whole problem that memoirs face. You can expose stuff that people don't want necessarily to have exposed about them. You know?
Totally. Totally. And I think if I had siblings, it would have been a lot more difficult because maybe they would be very angry with me.
Could you tell that story about how your parents said your sibling was lost? Because it became part of family folklore, really.
Oh.
Your mother up on the chair?
Yes, yes. It was really very strange how I found out. I was 12 years old, and I remember I was in the garage of our apartment house. And I always sat in the back because I used to sit in the front seat. And then one time my mother stopped and, like, I went flying to the dashboard. And from then, whenever she drove, I would sit in the back seat. So I was sitting in the back seat, and I was 12, and I asked my mother to tell me something about herself that she'd never told me. I was not prepared for what she told me, which was that well before I was born, she had had a baby who died. And this was a somewhat premature birth. She had, when she was 6.5 months pregnant, she climbed up on a step stool to change a light bulb and was reaching for the light bulb. This is how the story was told to me. She was reaching for the light bulb, and as she was reaching, she started to hemorrhage. And I think she went to the hospital. They stopped the bleeding. She went back in bed. She was in bed for another month. And then at 7.5 months, she lost the baby. She really started to hemorrhage. She almost died. She was in the hospital. She had transfusions. And she called it that mess. It was just a horrible thing. And the cause was a placenta previa, which, as I understand, it was not the changing the light bulb. But anyway, the baby lived for a day. And I didn't know this until I asked this question, that that my mother had had another baby before me that died. And anyway, it was...
Well, it was important that you asked the question. Otherwise, you never would have known.
Yeah.
You still have the cremains of your parents and those two...
Oh, yeah. I do.
Aren't Jews aren't supposed to... Are they? Cremate?
Cremate. My mother... she didn't talk about it much. I think she may have talked about once or twice, and she just said, I want to be cremated. But it was when my father was cremated. He had never said one thing or another about it, and I did have him cremated because he hadn't indicated any preference, and they were not observant Jews. And she later asked me if I thought that he felt it. And, I was kind of flabbergasted. It was like, no.
Yeah, they're in the closet, right?
Yeah, they're in the closet.
Here's a listener who says, I know that talking about death and dying is hard, but it's only hard because we made it hard. As a pastor in the United Church of Christ, I think that faith faith communities, can help change that by encouraging the discussions and teaching how to have discussions, and by leaders of the communities talking about it publicly. I encourage everyone to speak with their families about aging, death, and dying, and about what is important in dying for each of us, example being free of pain, getting to say goodbye to family, having music around them, breathing comfortably, etc.
Amen.
And another listener says, someone asked about the paperwork upon death and how to prepare for death. I think I heard this author on your program and have bought the book for several people, and they found it helpful. Scott Taylor Smith. Yes, we did have that author on. When Someone Dies, A Practical Guide to the Logistics of Death, and Merrill Lee recommends it. And we'll try to get another caller on here, and that's you. Carol, hi.
Carolyn Alameda?
Yes, that's you.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I wanted to say thank you to Ava. I was so touched hearing her voice, and I want her to know that there are younger people, I'm in my early 60s, who really value people of her time and would love to know her. And I wanted to add that my mother had a stroke a year before her death this past summer, and so she was able to tell us how she wanted to be kept alive or not. So when she did have her stroke and she couldn't talk, she decided not to have any more life-sustaining measures, but she was fully cognizant at 95. And so my family, her children in their 50s and 60s, spent the week basically sleeping. I remember my brothers lying on the floor around her bed, sleeping like puppies. And at night, everybody got up. It wasn't like, whose turn is it? That was, gee, I don't want to miss this last minute with our mom. And she died very peacefully. She had my brothers carried the kitchen table in. They had a candlelight dinner. She had a sip of her favorite wine, and she died.
Well, we thank you for that story, Carol. It's a good way to conclude here. Roshan, it's good to have you with us. Appreciate your being with us. She'll be speaking at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 p.m. And the book again is Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant? And we're here, and by the way, some of the cartoons are on our website, kqed.org. And before we conclude this morning's forum, I want to extend our thanks and our deep and abiding respect for our colleague Dave Iverson, who will be leaving his regular role as Forum's Friday host after tomorrow's forum to take on expanded duties with the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research and to focus on the distribution of his new documentary. We'll all miss his journalistic excellence and his ability to run a top-notch program week after week with a high level of intelligence and grace. We wish Dave the best in the new world he has chosen, and we applaud his ongoing commitment to public service. And also hope, though you won't be hearing him on a regular Friday basis, that you'll still be hearing his voice from time to time when his new busy schedule allows him to come in and host the Forum show, which he has done for years now with admirable distinction. Dave's a true professional, a gentleman, a keen and incisive thinker, and we wish him the best. Forum's produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Larberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our interns, Leslie Chang, Kathy Shield, Hannah Kingsley-Ma, Charlie Zaroff, Eric Nygaard, and Kaylin Dakin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.